General Sir David Thorne, Reel 4. What can you tell me about Sergeant Kelly?
I think Sergeant Kelly could be put into the category of those soldiers who have served in the regiment, have had a degree of initiative, but have been very well trained. And probably Sergeant Kelly was, he was absolutely at his limit as platoon sergeant, but he was a hell of a nice guy. Everybody liked him. He was honest, he was fit, he was practical, and he was a very good person to start with, because he steered me without ever embarrassing me. And that's quite an art. But I think it's fair to say that most platoon sergeants are brought up through the sergeant's mess and the regimental sergeant major. When a young subaltern arrives and he first picks up his platoon, they are taught to make sure that the officer doesn't make any catastrophic mistakes. And thank God, I think the officers on the whole are humble enough, if they've been pushed through Sandhurst and had proper a proper education, so to speak, they're humble enough to listen and not to let their pride get in the way of receiving excellent advice. And I have to say, all through my life as a soldier, I'm very happy to take advice from any level in the battalion, and as commanding officer, frequently on exercise or when talking with people at any rank. If they've got good ideas or good advice, then one went for it. And not only that, told every soldier in the battalion that it was Private Sanso or Corporal Sanso who'd pushed the idea forward, because that then generates very, very proactive attitude within the battalion, and it means that actually talent comes to the fore.
You said that he steered you. How did he do that? Was it by taking you on one side and giving you a word of advice if he thought you might be heading in the wrong direction?
Or no,
was
I
it
think by it's whisper in the ear.
It's whisper in the ear, is it?
Yeah. You want to do this, you want to do that. Shouldn't you do this? Straight away you're bloody well right. Mm. So it's just a discreet tipping the wink.
About what sort of things? About the way in which you were handling the soldiers in the platoon, or the way in which you were doing things, or
more about if you hadn't actually perhaps got your training method right when you first began, it was really to tip you that there was a better way of doing that and a better way of getting it across to the soldiers. I think it's much more that, and also it was in simple administration. You'd keep an eye on the administration as you should of the platoon. And he'd tell one if things were going on at all. He also had very good advice about the soldiers, which is what he, again, he should have available to him, because he knew them better than I did to begin with. You soon get to know them. The platoon commander's notebook and the commanding officer at the time, check with Bob Tanner Kane, was an extremely powerful commanding officer. He commanded. It's the second time he commanded the battalion, commanded in Berlin, and then he commanded it again in Hong Kong and in Costa for a while. And, the platoon commander's notebook was absolutely number one. He'd always come and inspect it himself and see that it was up to date and so on and so forth. So you needed to know your men backwards, because he would ask you and he'd expect you to know.
What sort of information would you put into the notebook?
Everything from the private soldiers. Basic things like age, home address, mother, father, next of kin, therefore. What sort of shot he was, whether he passed his fitness tests, what he'd like to field craft, the whole gamut of information, which you then condensed and had for the platoon, so you've got a cross cut of exactly how the platoon was performing and each of the individuals. I think probably in our battalion, And shooting at all was always very important, because all these were an infantry battalion. And the shooting was the one that, in a sense, you looked at first. It was age, it was educational qualifications as well, because they were going to get promoted. They were good soldiers. And the educational qualifications were important, as they always are now. So it's all that sort of good, solid background, basic information, which nowadays is on a computer. And then was in the platoon commander's notebook, and I trust still is, I don't know, because I've been out of the army for 10, 12 years.
How did you pick that up? Did you have formal interviews with all the soldiers of the platoon when you arrived?
Absolutely. Sat down with them. And formal is probably the wrong word, but it was seeing them down.
But it was on a one-to-one basis?
Yeah, it's one-to-one basis. Mm. Sat down. And also you drew the information from the company office and so on and so on. And then you just got to know him. And eventually, of course, you then get down to writing reports on them. And so, you know, that's the basis of that. So that the administration of the platoon really honed in, above all, the document that was the basis of that, much of it was the platoon commander's notebook.
When you took over your platoon, was it up to strength?
I can't honestly remember, but if you take it that I joined them, I think it was in March of 53, March of 54. And by midsummer, we were preparing for a major exercise on the plain. And while that was going on, the Middle East was erupting. And I remember General Jack Churchill, who was then the GOC of the Iron Division. So I think we're talking about three divisions.
Third Div was the Iron Division, yes. Right. And the Triangle is its badge.
Okay. And him coming to see us towards the end of June, beginning of July. And then the Prime Minister, Eden, coming to see us. And then the next thing is we were off on this exercise, and by then I think we'd been training on in early April. We'd gone training at Thetford, and I knew that my platoon had done pretty well, basically. You soon know when commanding officer proves you, and particularly one as direct and in a sense frightening as Bob Turner came. And so I knew they were doing well, and the commanding officers changed about August time, and Colonel Bill Brinkley arrived. Bob Turner came and went off to be, I think, the colonel in command of the tactics room at Warminster, and went on to be a major general later. When Bill Brinkley took us out on this exercise, and we'd completed the exercise, he got my platoon at the end to be the platoon which basically marked the route back, made sure everyone got through, and then picked up the tail end and so on. And that's quite a sort of significant thing for a platoon commander and his platoon to do at the end of a long exercise. And so, because of the lack of Royal Military Police, basically we did those duties, which is common sense, but it was also it was very interesting to do. And that told me that the platoon were doing pretty well. And so, in a sense, at the point in time when we were told we were going to Cyprus, which was almost straight after this exercise, I've got a very well-knit team now. And I was in charge of a regiment of boxing and things like that by then. And I'd been in the ring with soldiers and fought, and they knew that I could... They knew that I could stand up for myself, and I'd been involved in one of the very hard fights. And so they knew that the soldiers and I got on because of that. So I was beginning to be very comfortable and to love my soldiers and respect them. But in a sense, there was no amount of mutual in it, because I was a good shot and, and all those sort of things that soldiers... soldiers admire each other for. It's just lucky that I was good at sport, which is the other thing. So By the time one was heading for Cyprus with one's platoon, I had a very rewarding time already as a platoon commander. And you asked whether the platoon was up to strength. It wasn't to begin with, but of course by the time we started to head for Cyprus, and we were anyway a national, very large national service group, we were up to strength.
I was going to ask about that, because presumably you'd only have your soldiers in the platoon for a limited length of time, and then there'd be a turnover.
Mm.
What was this, a trickling through system of turnover?
I wish I thought it was that well constructed.
Or was it random then?
I would have thought there was a real attempt at getting the balance right, and on the whole it worked. I didn't have any problems, but I think once or twice platoons got slightly out of balance, and there were, you know, rather too many people who'd only been there 6 weeks to sort of 5 months.
New arrivals.
Yes, new arrivals. Mm. Too many of them were Mongolian. Mm. But on the whole, it worked pretty well. And I was never conscious that it was a problem in my platoon.
Did you have any regular private soldiers in the platoon as a sort of core on which to build?
Right. Of course, the non-commissioned, most of the non-commissioned soldiers were regulars. I don't think any private soldiers, but I may be wrong, I don't think so, I can recall. They tended to be... I certainly met one who was, I think I mentioned in my last talk, who was a soldier, Private Sitch, who was the... I may not remember his name last time. Mm-hmm. Private Sitch, who was the chap with the toupee, who looked after me when I did my first sort of week in the barracks, up in the town of barracks, as a private soldier. He is, I think, was the only long-term serving private soldier that I recall. There must have been others, but I suspect they were in the quartermaster store. They were working in MT and places like that, but not in the rifle platoon after a certain stage. I think it's all about fitness, physical ability to keep going.
What actually did you do on this big exercise at Thetford? Were you going through all the phases of conventional warfare, or were you doing other things?
Which was early, on the top of Turner Cane, we were doing live firing.
Yeah.
We were doing movement by night, ending up with a battalion night attack, organised by the commanding officer, but with the second in command being tested. Platoon attacks, live firing. So it was live firing, it was fitness. We marched obviously everywhere to get to the training, so we had to start very early in the morning to get there sometimes. And we certainly did a certain amount of night navigation, and that all tied in with the night attack at the end of the event. One thing I do remember very well, which is worth reminding on, about Bob Turner Kane. We came back from this training at Thetford in the battle area, and it was Easter. And the commanding officer said that he would personally inspect the personal weapons of all the companies before they could go on leave. So we set to, and we cleaned the rifles. He then inspected them, and he then assembled the battalion in the sort of sports place, gymnasium. And he stood up and he said that the rifles were simply not good enough, that therefore the officers would stay behind to clean them, and the men would go on leave. So the officers stayed behind and cleaned the rifle. And we learned an extremely good lesson.
It's called rubbing it in, isn't it?
Absolutely. In front of all the soldiers, it was extremely funny. And I thought, bloody good. Never forgotten it.
Was the exercise an opposed one?
No. Yes, it was. I mean, there were a few. On the night attack.
Skeleton enemy.
Yeah, there was an enemy from the equivalent of the Wrecky Platoon. Now, the exercise in August was a brigade exercise, 19th Brigade, as part of training for nuclear war, so we were into digging these bloody great trenches, and they were in cover at the time. I can remember digging a chalk, which I had memories of course, on Tomb Commander's course, which I went on just before I. I did that and Warminster in the summer of. I got my years wrong. It's the summer of 55 we're talking about here. And the summer of 54 and the spring, I was actually on the platoon commander's small arms course and the tactics course. And I had my first experience of the chalk and trying to get through that. But I was very, very impressed with platoon commander's courses, both of them. That was another case where that one was a good shot.
You talked about digging big trenches for nuclear warfare. Mm. How deep would you go to make a trench which was considered good enough?
Deep as we had to for a big mature. As I recall, in those days, we would go down to about sort of 7 or 8 foot, or certainly 6 foot, and then with a bit of overhead cover. Now, by the time after we'd been to Cyprus and in 1957-58, then the whole thing was more sophisticated, and the materials to do the digging in with, the corrugated iron, the prop stuff, support which you were doing, the engineer stores were much more effective. I don't recall a lot of engineer stores on this exercise. And there again, it was about 10 days. It was reasonably fine weather. I can remember driving out in September from Colchester and coming back towards the end of the month. And then in October, we were warned to go to Cyprus and within a fortnight.
So you hadn't done any training, there was no specific exercise you can remember for counterinsurgency. It was all conventional.
Absolutely not. What we'd done was sort of on the square stuff. Lined up in a solid square with all the normal sort of tannoys and signs and so on. We practiced that just before we went to Cyprus.
That's riot control drill, I take
that's
it.
That's right.
With the hollow square, the sniper,
right.
The riot act, and so on.
With the chap saying, shoot my brother, he's in there.
The man in the green pullover.
Absolutely.
He's always the baddie, not the black hat, the green pullover.
Absolutely,
How much notice did you get again to Cyprus? You mentioned you came back from exercise and you were warned you were off to Cyprus.
I think it was
Cyprus.
14 days. It was very short. And I think it was because Cyprus was starting to boil over. Anyhow, I can, of course, moving down to Ogbourne St. George and then flying off from there in... Presumably it was Dakotas.
Where would you be flying from? Would that be Lynham or Fairford or somewhere like that?
I just have a memory it was Ogbourne St. George.
Ogbourne itself?
Yes. But what's my airfield? I don't know.
There's a big camp on the Marlborough Downs, or at least there was, a brigade camp.
I think we moved in those, and then just went out the next day. We went down out in a series of flights, which... should have gone direct to Cyprus, but they got scattered all over the Mediterranean. We landed in Cyprus. I mean, the two things that really sort of struck in our mind about the actual arrival, and we were camped in Sibia, I think it's called Sibia's camp, which was just outside Nicosia, tented camp. I just bring a picture to show you. We had a haircut there. Two things really struck my mind. First, was I climbed on a vehicle with my platoon. I was in the front with the driver, and we were going along, and the senior RAF officer, for some reason, I didn't like the way the driver was driving. He was in his car, so he stopped the vehicle and he gave me an imperial bollocking. For the way the driver didn't know, the other didn't know. And what struck me, and it just went straight over my head, because in a sense, you know, I sort of sort of tension and let him bollock me. But it was the first time I felt there was an officer who had lost his cool and was doing absolutely the wrong thing. And in front of a whole lot of soldiers who would think exactly the same as me. And I thought, you know, poor old chap. The other impression was my twin brother, who was commanding, I think, the anti-tank platoon at the time. His plane took off, the wind caught it, and he ended up in French North Africa. And I can't remember which country, but I think it must be Tunisia. They landed at this airport, and they weren't allowed off the plane because the French had had a pretty big insurgency problem themselves. And our little old North Swedes were
boiling.
Yeah, were looking out of the window, and they saw this other French plane, and they saw the French National Service soldiers being forced off the plane by military police at the point of a gun. The gun in their back. They thought, what are we doing?
What are we doing here?
Absolutely. And I said to the adjutant, after my brother hadn't come for 4 or 5 days, I said, you know, is he all right? And the adjutant went off and made some inquiries, and then said, yes, he's in Tunisia, and they're coming along shortly. Which is one of these little nuances about having brothers in the same regiment. Because I was worrying about him. I think there'd been another platoon commander, I probably
wouldn't have worried. Were all your platoon on the same aircraft? Were you sort of put into packages?
We were part of all on one decade.
So, and you mentioned General Jack Churchill. What sort of impression did you get of him when he came to see you?
Direct, straightforward. Iron Jack was his name. I think a very good impression, proper general. Not all that. I didn't see him much. Not really. Not all that warm, but. But a good authoritative presence, not commanding, but authoritative. Yeah. Whereas Eden, when he came, was flopping around all over the place, frankly. I mean, was suffering, I think, from overwork. We gave him a good day, he had a good time, but I felt here's a man with no strength, physical strength, and probably, I mean, he looked as if he was an exhausted man. And of course, we were coming up to Suez almost then, weren't we? No, we weren't. It was going to the next year.
56, yes.
Yeah.
But there were difficulties with the Middle East.
I think so. But he looked almost a fate. And as if the wind would blow him away. Tall, slim, intelligent, exceedingly intelligent, but you didn't feel there was command there at all again in him. He was going through the motions.
Did you get briefed on the political situation in Cyprus in particular, or on the Middle East in general before you went out?
Yes, but nowhere near as extensively as we would now.
Did that briefing go to the soldiers as well as to officers?
Yes. Well, it's up to the officers then to pass on the briefing to the soldiers. And I think the sort of things we did brief the soldiers about, first of all, in general about the political situation, but much more about how they could keep out of trouble and how to, you know, attention to the problems of heat, drink, exercise in the heat, all these common sense, very down to earth things, and VD and all that sort of, you know, jazz, so that they went there as far as possible with their eyes open, but with their platoon sergeant and their corporals and their officers bloody well keeping an eye on them and helping them forward, because the truth is, we had some very, very able soldiers there. And we also had some good little thick ones who were first rate. But, you know, there's a very high level of IQ in that infantry battalion at that time because of national service. Very able people.
When you were talking to them about what was going on in Cyprus and the Middle East, did you find that they were interested in the political side of it?
Bewildered.
Bewildered.
Because events were happening so quickly. Mm. Basically, suddenly we were away from our comfortable barracks and just completing exercise, thinking, right, now we can get down some preparatory training for the next training season, so to speak, back to basics. And suddenly, we were off, basically, being issued with the kit get ourselves and put the kid in Cyprus. Great excitement, but it was a sense of bewilderment. We were on a train, and there was no stopping that train. It was heading for onboard St George and then for Cyprus, and it may have been a bit longer than a fortnight, but it wasn't a lot longer.
Was that long enough to actually get yourself fully prepared and packed up to move as a battalion?
Well, we did it. Mm. Mm. I may have sort of foreshortened it a bit, but whether it was 2 weeks or a month from a standing start for a national service battalion, that, you know, is quite an interesting sort of process. We were certainly in Cyprus by mid-November, and we'd come back from the exercise in early October. But maybe it was a month, the whole process, but I mean, it really took off with a fortnight to care.
What sort of
excellent adjutant, by the way, Turnbull. Alex Turnbull, and he really held the battalion together. He was a brilliant officer who never got recognised by the army, because he was a bit unassuming in some ways, but he held the battalion together. Bill Brinkley was lovely as front man, but Alex Turnbull, who actually a good thing, he'd been adjutant 4 or 5 times.
Well, it is the adjutant who has to deal with that kind of administration and business, isn't it? He's like the business manager in a way.
That's exactly what he did. And he had so much respect from everybody because he was a gentleman, but he was tough as anything. He was Australian. And he and the regiment of Sergeant Major were an extremely strong couple. Extremely strong, and Alex Turnbull had the respect of everybody. And Alex Turnbull used to have a sort of mill board, which is very easy to get some. And I learnt from him, and until I finished in the army, I always had a mill board with me. Where did I pick it up? Picked up with Alex Turnbull and his marvellous sense of order.
You were saying that you had kit for specifically for Cyprus. What did that consist of? What did the kit for Cyprus?
Well, we're really talking about the clothing. Mm. It was clothing, and then we picked up the counterinsurgency stuff out there. So we've flown out to the kit. We've got ourselves dressed. There was a certain amount of stuff actually in Colchester, which we practiced with. But we went out to Cyprus, and then we picked up the riot gear, things like that, what I've seen in Cyprus.
What did riot gear consist of in those days?
Something to beat people with.
A stick.
Something to withstand.
Do you remember the shape of the shield? Round or square or?
Card, I wish I could. Recall a card. So we're talking about.
Presumably the steel helmet would be.
Oh God, yes. Steel helmet, something to beat people with, rifle, something to protect yourself with in terms of a shield. And not everybody had both of those. And then you had the banners and things all prepared and so on. So that, and they were all provided, basically. We assembled for. And writing was not a great feature, as I recall, in Nicosia. And there's a number of searches, calling searches, but I remember being sent off with sea cover, the cover of the